Hello and welcome to Ditching Hourly. I'm Jonathan Stark. My guest today is Brian Dunning. Brian's an old friend of mine who I met back when we were both building FileMaker solutions for clients who we build on an hourly basis. Over the years, Brian has transitioned away from trading time for money to the most purely value-based model I've ever encountered. He now runs a donation-supported nonprofit called Skeptoid Media. As a former dev, I wanted to have Brian come on the show to hopefully inspire you to consider packaging up and selling your expertise in a novel way. Enjoy. Brian, welcome to the show.
Hey, great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Just for context, could you give folks a little bit of background on what you do now and sort of where you came from? And then we'll sort of drill into that in detail as we go through the episode.
Yeah, well, that's a big arc because what I do now is so unrelated to where I came from. So where I've ended up is I'm basically, for what I do all day is being a podcaster. And in more detail, it's a podcast called Skeptoid. It's been going for 11 years. It comes out once a week. It's about 12 minutes long, very short format. And it's the main product of my company, which is a nonprofit, which is called Skeptoid Media. And we also produce documentary films and related educational materials. And the idea is that all of this is provided for free to educators. So the whole company is completely supported by private grants and donations, the bulk of which is micropayments supporting the podcast. But it all goes to a much larger and much broader source than just one podcast. That just happens to be where I spend most of my time. But where I came from and how this began is this began as a hobby back in the mid-2000s for what I was doing for a living, which was being a FileMaker consultant. And I think that's where you and I first met, probably, I don't even want to say, 20-something years ago. Right. I think I was doing that for since the mid-90s, so probably over 20 years. Sometimes I worked individually as a consultant. Sometimes I worked for a consulting firm, just kind of for an hourly rate. And I was always looking for, what's something that I can sell that's, going to bring in money without me having to physically work with my own two hands and sell hours of my life away. Mm-hmm. So, that's basically the story.
That's wild. And, I remember back then when I first heard about Skeptoid, and I was like, I don't think I've ever told you this, but it was such a like needle off the record type of like, wait a minute, what? I mean, podcasting, I knew about it at the time. It wasn't really new at that point, I don't think. It's hard to remember the timeline, but I remember thinking like this, it was just really hard for me to process two such different things. I just sort of knew you in a particular way. You had this particular identity, and then there was this whole other side to what you were doing. And I think, was there a sort of middle ground there in your transition that we were doing shrink wrap products, or am I?
Yeah, with varying success, I was trying to get out of the hourly consulting all the time, and I had some developer tools that were sold off of a website, and I actually still have some of those because they do still bring in some money, and so there's no reason to turn them off, but it's not something that takes up any of my time. I did have one little detour during my consulting days, which was in the Silicon Valley, the dot-com boom. I was a co-founder of a company that had a venture capital investment, and so I had to move to Silicon Valley and did that whole thing. And that's a whole other conversation for another time, because that's a wild story in itself. Mm-hmm. But as part of that company, we needed to distribute a piece of software to all of the customers who used this service. And that was something that I actually built as a FileMaker runtime. And it had a quarter of a million users worldwide. So I think arguably it was probably the most successful single FileMaker runtime software ever. I would love to know if anyone has stats to see if that's true or not. But based on the success of that, after the whole dot-com bust and boom, I then found that all kinds of people were coming to me saying, hey, you built this. Can you help me build this? So it'd be dentists, doctors, lawyers, whoever, who had something they had made in FileMaker, and they wanted to sell it to other people in their business. So they were looking to hire me as a consultant to help them with that. So I did that for a few years. I had a training course called To Market, which was pretty successful for a few years. The consulting just ended up being a more steady flow of income. And because most of these people who had these software ideas, they were bad ideas, quite frankly, and they weren't going to work. And few of them did. So what I ended up doing really was taking people's consulting money to help them with something that I knew was not going to be successful for them. And that's not very fulfilling to do personally or professionally. So I kind of ended up defaulting back to the hourly consulting again, you know, which is fine. You make money, but you just kind of get old working with the sweat of your two hands.
Mm-hmm.
So I was very fortunate to be able to transition into the new nonprofit educational business, which is, you know, kind of, as you point out, it's quite a detour, but it's a very fulfilling professionally.
That's fascinating. And you're preaching to the choir, of course. So the thing that I want to impress upon people, the dear listener, is that I think in spite of the fact that the podcast is a different subject area, it's not necessarily, it's still something that people could do. So the kind of picture I'd like to paint today is a path from toiling with your two hands, like you pointed out, in a technical profession and moving into just a different kind of business model, even if it's not full-time. It could be that you're just sort of diversifying your income streams or whatever it is. And it could be that you pick an interest that's unrelated to your technical expertise like Brian here did, or it could be something that is technical. You know, maybe you're really into, I don't know, profiling JavaScript frameworks, or you're really into Node or iOS or whatever it is. You know, and you could perhaps package up that expertise in a different way. And what I hope we can get to is, how does a business like that work? How do you make a living doing a sort of nonprofit educational kind of endeavor?
How do you make a living as a podcaster is, of course, the perennial question that people have been asking since about 2004. So I'll go into a little bit more detail about how that transition. Like I said, when it started, my first episode was October 2006. At that point, it was just a hobby. And I figured I was going to do 5 or 10 episodes and get it out of my system and be done with it. But for whatever reason, the show that I was doing, and it's basically a science show. It's a show about the science behind urban legends, is the best elevator pitch for it. So if there's something you've heard, some conspiracy theory, urban legend, alternative medicine scheme, paranormal story, UFO story, anything like this you might have heard of, chemtrails, there's been an episode on that. And it's exploring the true science behind what's going on or not going on. And often it's not. It ends up being the sociology behind why people think this is a thing when it's not. But anyway, for some reason, I was fortunate enough that my show spoke to people. People responded. People really enjoyed it. And they started sending me feedback and episode ideas. And I was still consulting full time, so I never asked for donations or anything like that. In fact, sometimes people would ask me if they could donate, and I said, no, don't worry about it. It's more hassle than it's worth. It's something I'm doing for fun. And what ended up happening over the course of about the next 2 years is I started finding out that teachers were using this substantially in classes. And I think the reason has to do with what's different between my podcast and most other podcasts, which is that it's short format, single format. It's 100% content. There's no, hey, here's what I've been up to last week. Here's, you know, what my cat looks like. It's pure content and it's very short. So when you search on the website for, you know, 9/11 truther or whatever, you will find exactly that episode, and that episode contains nothing but that subject. So it's something that is useful for teachers who are doing a particular unit, whether that's a unit on critical thinking or some particular science. So I decided, gee, maybe I better start focusing on this more often. And gradually it kind of became more formalized. The website began offering more formalized resources, started making some videos. There was a documentary film back in 2008 called Here Be Dragons, which is about kind of a general introduction to critical analysis of pop phenomena. Boy, that's a horrible pitch, isn't it? That's a horrible and that was very successful in classrooms. So I started taking donations in 2010. It had taken up so much of my time that I started doing it full time, even though there wasn't enough money coming in to make a living yet. So I was still kind of cruising on my savings and everything. 2012, it became a nonprofit because it was clear that donation supported for educational purposes was the dominant reason that people were supporting the show. And it's just gone from there. It makes a living now, and every time there's enough beyond the minimum paycheck, then it goes toward a project which gets produced. There's two video series now. There's two more films in production. We just completed one film this year. It's just a wild ride, and I enjoy every second of it. And not once am I ever getting an hour older, selling an hour of my time, which is just, I'm ecstatic every day when I think of it. I just have so much fun and enjoy what I do so much.
Mm, yeah. I know the feeling. It's so different when you, I don't know. It's kind of hard to describe. I mean, you're doing a good job painting the picture. That's wonderful. Right. But it's a very different feeling when you're working. So like when I used to bill by the hour, I can remember thinking like at the end of a coding session, like four hours, I'm like, I just made $800 or something like that. It was such a different mentality. It was so much more mercenary. And I just felt like, I felt very safe when I was on the clock, is the only way to say it. It felt like, okay, things are good. I'm making money right now. Mm-hmm. And it's funny when you switch over to, even if you're still doing software projects, when you switch over to fixed fee projects, however you calculate the price, whether it's value-based or some other way, the feeling is completely different because every hour you spend coding, you're losing money. So you want to get it done as quickly as possible in a way that is, you know, that still has high quality because you're on the hook if there are bugs and stuff. So it's not like you can just, you know, sort of do a bad job and get it done quickly. You have to do a good job and get things done. And you're motivated to get things done very quickly. And I found that it was psychologically, it was a surprise, but I think it's a little bit scary, but I think it should be because that's the feeling that the customer has. And I guess we don't really need to get into that too much for this conversation, but what I'm getting at is maybe if you could talk a little bit more about the difference in psychology and the shift that, if you can remember, because it's been a while now, but if you can remember the shift, the struggles that you might have had, you know, like maybe questioning like, wow, is this ever going to make money? Things like that.
You know, I remember that some of the worst professional memories actually come from that. I think one of the lowest points in my software career was right after the whole Silicon Valley bust boom. Unfortunately, our company came into that a little bit late. We came in just as the VCs were starting to shut companies down. So even though our company was successful and profitable before we took an investment, after we took the investment, it almost immediately became unprofitable and they started shutting the company down. And one of the early things that happened was they put these ridiculous caps on our salaries so that we couldn't even really exist in Silicon Valley anymore. And so, you know, there's headlines and articles, hey, multi-million dollar investment in the company. Well, that's what it looks like to the public. But for us, it was actually a huge step backward. So here I am. They eventually did shut the company completely down, the end of this 2-year slide from being awesome and profitable to being a Silicon Valley company and being continually shut down. I was pretty much destitute when I finally left that and stepped away. We had like no savings left. And so I'm desperately trying to sort of restart this consulting business that had been on hiatus for 2 years. And so I'm taking any job I can get. I'm doing all kinds of emailing and everything. I was fortunate in that I had some name recognition from having done I was a technical advisor on FileMaker Advisor magazine, and that always gave me great name recognition. And that was very fortunate. That was probably the one thing that allowed me to build up a new consulting business in just a few weeks. Mm-hmm. But, you know, when you had all of these customers were very price conscious, they wanted low hourly rates. I was desperate for cash. I'll be honest right now. There are times when I padded my billing a little bit because I'm sitting there and I just didn't know what else to do to make ends meet. And knowing that I did that, that's a horrible, horrible thing. never seriously. You know, I'd mark off an hour when it was only 35 minutes or, you know.
Yeah, round up.
Yeah, like, you know, you bill 7 hours for 5.5 hours worth of work once in a while. I'd always feel horrible. I'd feel guilty. I'd vow that I'd make it up to them again next week by underbilling. And, you know, you just never get that opportunity. So those are very dark times psychologically. Mm-hmm. You're working your butt off. You're trying as hard as you can, and you still can't really give the client any good service. It was very hard to be that person in that position.
I just want to add a comment to people who are thinking right now that they don't pad their hours. Guess what? You do pad your hours. You want to know why? Because you're not working as efficiently as you could be. Because if you are billing by the hour, if you're selling your time, you have no financial incentive to create code libraries or toolkits that will allow you to work faster. There's just no reason to do it. So you don't. So you could actually be delivering whatever you're working on an hourly basis now much more quickly and therefore more cheaply, but you're not doing it. Because why would you? It doesn't make sense. And I recognize that it's not the exact same thing. I'm sort of stretching it a little, but that is the thing about hourly billing that drives me insane, especially as a software developer, me or you, dear listener, that we love efficiency. We almost crave it. It's like core to our personalities in most cases. And yet we don't apply it to our own work because that would penalize us financially. So anyway, sorry for the aside, but that's
very well stated. I mean, that very aptly describes what I was going through.
Yeah, you could have just bought a slower computer and felt fine about it. Said, oh, sorry, my computer's really slow. Like, why would you ever upgrade to a faster computer? It doesn't make sense.
Well, or you know, there's also kind of like dilemmas. It's like, okay, I'm for this client, I've got to set this script running and it's going to take 3 hours to run. Do I bill for those 3 hours or not?
Yeah, it happens all the time. Well, this hour was spent kind of educating myself about something on their behalf, but it's something I feel like I should have known. So I guess I won't charge them for that, or maybe I should, or I have this starter file that I spent 100 hours building. Should I bill them for the 100 hours for the starter file? That doesn't seem fair. Like the whole thing is the problem is that it's a nonsensical way to bill for work. So yep, of course you end up with all these dilemmas.
All of that.
Cool. Well, so I'm kind of curious from an advice standpoint. So people are listening that are software developers, and others, but mostly people that bill by the hour, lots of software developers. And I do think in general, people should be looking for other ways to diversify their income. But I suppose it must be true that it's not for everyone. So like, you know, this particular path we're talking about, let's just sum it up as podcasting. I mean, I know, I don't want to exaggerate here. I know at least three people, not counting you, Brian, who are making 4 and 5 figures per month by selling sponsorships on their shows. And these are not hugely popular shows. I mean, we're talking about a couple thousand downloads per show in some cases. I know one person who has a very popular show is making, you know, $20,000, $30,000, $40,000 a month. But
well, hey, I need to get on board with whatever advertising company that is. If they're making 5 figures with a couple thousand downloads,
yeah,
I need to get on that train.
Well, I mean, that's, you know, it'd be a very different thing for you though, because of the model that you have, I think. So the question though, I suppose, is over the years, have you found that there are certain people for whom like podcasting just not a good fit, or certain topics that just aren't a good fit, or kind of asking for your advice about how somebody could ask themselves, you know, might I be good at this? What should I focus on? How should I format the shows? Now, it doesn't need to be, I'm not trying to have like a here's how you podcast kind of conversation, but just at a high level, those sorts of things.
Well, I think that most of those questions aren't relevant to the one question, which is your show going to be successful and what makes it successful? And that's something that there's just no answer to. My educational background is in computer science and then writing for film and television. And I had a writing teacher once who told me this great piece of advice, which I've always remembered, is that with Dr. Frankenstein, I can teach you how to connect the knee bone to the leg bone to the head bone. I can teach you how to screw the brain into the skull. But the one thing I can't teach is the lightning that makes it all come to life. Mm. So you can do everything right for building a podcast and your show still might suck. It still just might not have that spark that's going to make people respond to it. I can't tell you what that spark is. I feel that I've been fortunate that my show seems to have that spark, and I wouldn't be here if it didn't. If I bought the right microphone and had the right show schedule and the right show format and the right guests and did all of that stuff correctly, I still wouldn't be here if there wasn't just that some special something, whatever it is, that makes Skeptoid successful. I do guest appearances on other podcasts just like this all the time. And so many of these shows are badly done. The interviewer is terrible at interviewing. And you know, it's like 10% of these podcasts are really worth listening to in my somewhat informed opinion. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I can give a few things that I have done that I think are important. And number one is consistency. Your show has to be consistent in every metric. It has to be a consistent length. It has to be a consistent format. It has to have consistent audio quality. If it's got music or sound effects or backgrounds, those have to be consistently inserted. If you've got advertising, that has to be at a consistent spot in the show. And most importantly is the show has to come out on a consistent schedule. It's got to be weekly, and it's got to be at the exact same time on the exact same day every week. Those, I think, are very important. Because if you're not consistent in your release schedule, you're going to lose listeners faster than you can catch them. It's a full-time job for me. I probably spend 60% of my time working on the podcast and the other 40% of the time just running the nonprofit. And there's a billion things you have to do to run a business. There is a board of directors, which I'm not on. And, you know, they do their thing. And I'm the only full-time salaried employee, though, so most of the grunt work lands on my shoulders. So the time that I do have to work on the podcast, you know, that's like my recreation time. That's the fun yeah. time. Right. I get to, I basically paid to screw around on the internet, look up fun stuff.
Yes.
And I get to be paid to be a writer, which is what I always wanted to do.
Yep. So, wow, that's great. All right, cool. So that's probably a good place to leave it. Did we leave anything out? Is there anything else that I forgot to ask?
I would just say that looking back at all of these, you know, these kind of various careers that I've had over this 20, 25 year period we're talking about, the reason that I'm happiest now is twofold. Number one is because it's something that I'm doing stuff that's fun for me that I would do anyway as a hobby. But number two, and I think this is probably the most significant, is that my success or failure depends on donations and people's decision to make a donation. That's purely voluntary by them. And they only do it if they genuinely feel they're getting value and they genuinely appreciate what I do. So my success or failure depends on whether I'm making people happy by their estimation of it, not by my estimation of it. And the fact that that's worked for me is just so fulfilling and makes me so happy that I can't even describe it.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, that's the opposite of hourly billing, of course.
Right. It literally is because people are, I mean, you are operating in the purest value environment of anyone I've ever talked to, because I've never talked to someone who survived on donations before. So it is exactly, happiness is totally subjective. Happiness is the value. You could call it, you know, mental well-being or whatever you want to call it, but basically it's happiness. I'm happier now than I was before. And that could be from a 6-month software project, or it could be from listening to a 17-minute episode of Skeptoid, or whatever you said, 12 minutes. So when you,
13
when
and
you
a half.
Okay. So the opposite of that is when you just believe that you're worth $100 an hour and they can tell you to rake their lawn, wash their car, or build software. That's up to them. But my time's worth $100 an hour. My time's worth $200 an hour. And the sense that value is something that's intrinsic to an object in an objective way is just flat wrong. It's an illusion. Value is always in the mind of the buyer or the recipient, the other person. You know, if you're trading thing for thing, or trading money for thing, or money for service, the value is always subjective and it's always on the buyer side. And I just love how pure of an example of this it is. And oh, by the way, isn't it gratifying emotionally to have that kind of feedback? I just, it's amazing.
It is the biggest contributor to my happiness level. That's for sure. Well, other than my family, of course.
Of course. That. Well, that's fabulous. Well, thanks so much, Brian. Where's the best place for people to find out more about you and Skeptoid?
Skeptoid.com is the website for the podcast, and that has links to out to all of the other projects. The company has a website, skeptoid.org, but that's mostly just a business website for the nonprofit for, you know, tax purposes to access all of those nonprofit forms and all that stuff. But skeptoid.com, there's transcripts for all of the episodes going back 11 years are all on the website, which is great for Google placement, by the way. 600 pages, all of original high quality content. That's awesome. That's your SEO tip for the day.
Yeah. It's a great show. It's one of my favorite podcasts. So,
well, thank you very much. Appreciate that.
You definitely changed the way I think about this sort of pop culture, you know, oogie boogie, whatever you want to call it.
You hear that, people? If he says it changed his way of thinking, just think what it'll do for you.
I know. I'm very closed-minded, so. All right. Thanks a lot, Brian.
Thank you.
The next time someone asks you for your hourly rate, this is what I'd like you to say. I don't have one. To learn what to say next, visit valuepricingbootcamp.com to sign up for my free email course. Again, that website is valuepricingbootcamp.com.